Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. This week, we're talking about the American labor force and signs that discouraged workers are finally coming back in and getting jobs. Let's rewind the clock a year, because we're talking about changes in the labor force over the last year and how the numbers have looked a little better. Last year, Pat St. Clair was about to get a part-time job that paid about $8 an hour. Pat has been a journalist for over 30 years, and this wasn't really where she was expecting to find herself.
So at that point, I had been looking for a job for, probably 6 months or so, or 7 months or so. And I thought, okay, this is 5 minutes from my home, and it's something to do with my time. I was so bored. I didn't really have a plan of action.
Pat was laid off in 2013 after a long career at CNN. She'd been an anchor on Headline News, writer, editor, supervisor, just about every journalism job you can think of. She struggled to find work for a couple of years after being laid off, thinking the next great job was right around the corner.
I was working at home, you know, 6, 7, sometimes 8 hours a day, looking for jobs that were appropriate, polishing my resume, and nothing. I got no bites at all. It was really discouraging, and I just, you know, I started thinking, is it me? What's going on here? Because my resume is, I have a pretty good resume. I'm highly qualified in this field.
Pat landed a couple of jobs during those years, but in 2017, after having been unemployed again, she'd given up. She started drawing Social Security because she thought her career was over.
I was just done. I said, I am tired of applying for jobs and nothing's happening. Applying for jobs I'm really qualified for and not even getting an interview. So I just figured I would go ahead and apply for Social Security.
And then after she'd already given up, she started part-time as an editor at an Atlanta NPR station, which turned into a full-time job with benefits. She started on December 10th.
Truly, if this had not come along as a full-time position, then I was just going to deal with Social Security and then maybe try to do some consulting or, you know, something to that place where journalists go after they, you know, leave the field.
Right. Okay. Tell me if you find it, tell me about it so I can know how to get there ultimately. Pat, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us, and congratulations on the new full-time job.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you so much.
And now, to explain why people like Pat are finding the economy in a little better shape and re-entering the workforce, we've got Jared Bernstein, who is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And he's a former chief economist to Vice President Joe Biden. Jared, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Ben.
I appreciate it. All right, so we brought you on to talk about jobs and the labor force and who's coming back to work these days. But since we just mentioned Joe Biden and the fact that you did work for him and he's in the news and thinking about a 2020 presidential run, I wanted to ask you, is Joe Biden running for president?
Yeah, you're not the first person to ask me that. I know no more than anyone else, but I think any kind of cognizant, plugged-in reader of the newspaper would recognize that he's definitely leaning in. I think it's a decision he hasn't quite made yet. I mean, the one thing I'll say from having some interaction with the VP is that his family is hugely important to him. He's gone through more personal loss than anyone should have to endure in their life, and that's going to be a huge part of his decision. But that's really all I know at this point. I think the interesting thing about the question is a lot of Democrats are asking themselves who can beat Trump, and a lot of people think Biden can do that. I will tell you this. As I schlep about the country doing my economics thing, a lot of people come up to me and say, can you please tell Joe Biden to run for president? And they don't say that about anybody else, so go figure.
Got it. All right. So let's get to the business at hand, which is jobs and the labor market, and particularly, you know, the latest jobs report, 312,000 added, which was a big number, bigger than anyone expected. And the size of the labor force went up to 63.1%, which is historically not great, but definitely moving in the right direction. And we've had several months in a row of several hundred thousand workers coming back into the labor force. And of course, your friends like Larry Kudlow in the White House will argue, hey, what we're doing is working. Tax cuts are working. We're getting people back to work. What do you make of it? Do you accept that argument?
Well, weirdly enough, Larry Kudlow actually is a friend of mine. We disagree on a lot of stuff, especially on tax policy. But I've always liked Larry. I think, actually, that those who thought that the job market was at full capacity, you know, a year or more ago, and a lot of prominent people thought that, I think the evidence is that they were wrong and that there's more room to run in the American labor market than lots of economic people thought. That is a critically important insight. It may seem kind of obvious based on the numbers you're citing, but you know, if you think of the economy as kind of a glass of water, or the labor market as a glass of water, a lot of people thought that glass was full. So that if you added any more demand to the economy, say through the stimulus of a tax cut or a spending promo type we've had, all you would get would be spillover from that glass of water, a big splash, which in economic terms just means more inflation. It doesn't mean more jobs, wages, income, economic activity. Instead, there was a little more room in that glass of water. It appears, or maybe even more than a little. We don't know. And so testing the capacity of the job market has been a real plus for the American economy, American workers, as you've suggested. It's pulled people in from the sidelines, and that's been a great development.
But you are not going to give credit to the tax cuts for the fact that we had this big jobs number and that we've got a rising labor force participation rate, as Kudlow would do.
Well, I'm not going to not give credit in the following sense. So the tax cut and the spending, we spent $300 billion on the deficit on spending for 2018 and 19. And of course, the tax cut was adding, maybe $150 billion to the economy in both of those years. That kind of a fiscal impulse is, I think, partly responsible for the faster growth rate and the lower unemployment rate. Now, I yield to no one in arguing that this tax cut was a huge waste of economic resources. But I think people, if we're being honest, we have to square the fact that we've stimulated an economy closing in on full employment, which is a very unusual thing to do. We've almost never done that before through this fiscal policy, and it hasn't overheated. In fact, it's sent unemployment down to rates that a lot of people didn't think we could achieve without pushing up inflation. So in one sense, the fiscal experiment has been important and beneficent. In another sense, it's been a massive waste of trillions of dollars and an exacerbator of economic inequality. I guess the best way to put it, because I know that I'm being an economist with at least two hands here, but I think the best way to put it is that if I were going to spend a couple of trillion dollars to stimulate an economy that was already heating up, I never would have done it by giving a bunch of money to rich people and corporations. I would have invested in infrastructure and education and anti-poverty programs, things that would actually ameliorate inequality, not exacerbate it.
Right. I mean, his argument is that you cut on the supply side, corporations, and then they invest in some of the things you're talking about, research and development and new plants and hiring.
Okay, so that's a really important piece. I don't want to let that slip, because what I'm talking about is actually quite different than what Kudlow and Hassett and the other economists in the White House are talking about. What they're talking about, and in fact, they're not just talking about it, they wrote this in their budget, is a permanent increase in the growth rate of real GDP in the economy. They think that their tax cut has stimulated enough investment to boost productivity growth and really kick up the supply side of the economy. I'm sure that's wrong, at least based on incoming data. And there's a really good empirical test for it, which I'll get to in a second. But the critical difference is I'm saying they basically engaged in Keynesian stimulus. They think they engaged in Laffarian supply side investment oriented stimulus, and the data support my interpretation thus far, as has always been the case. The supply side fairy dust has never worked. So the empirical test is, does the economy slow down from its current growth rate of around 3% to something closer to 2% later this year? And if that happens, it's an indicator that my view is the correct one.
Okay, and you say based on incoming data, you're already sort of proven right. What are you talking about?
So investment. So there has been nothing like an investment boom from the tax cut. Now, these are early days, folks will say, but there was just so much investment incentives in the tax plan, 100% expensing of equipment, the big cut in the corporate rate, and yet we've seen really nothing special, nothing really above trend in terms of investment spending. And that's one of the first links in their chain. So that's part one. Part two is that, and this is a forecast, so this isn't as, I don't weight this as heavily as part one, but part two is that the most common forecast you see is for GDP growth to slow down at the end of this year. So that's where I'm coming from.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's talk about the labor force more broadly and what's happening there. You dig into the BLS data, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who compiles all this for us, and you see that the number of discouraged workers has dropped around 21% over the course of the last year. And that's mainly coming from young people, 16 to 25, and then older people, 55 and over. Actually, middle-aged workers, 25 to 54, are more discouraged now than they were a year ago. Why do you think that is? Why are we seeing those particular changes?
Well, there are a group of people who sit out the labor market and don't get counted in the statistics typically. So unemployment, and I think people don't always recognize this. If you're unemployed, you've got to be looking for work. If you've given up because there's just no jobs where you live, or maybe some other more personal reason, you're not counted in the unemployment statistic. And in fact, last month's jobs report was interesting in this regard. The unemployment rate went up. It was a very strong jobs report, but the unemployment rate went up by from 3.7 to 3.9%. Why? Because a bunch more people came in off the sidelines into the labor market. And you mentioned younger folks and older folks. Those groups are typically sideliners, particularly in parts of the country. We're not talking about San Francisco and, you know, New York City or the D.C. area where unemployment is really low because demand has just been so strong there. We're talking about some of the rural areas, some of the parts of the country that have been left behind. And I know from your political work and writings that you're very aware that such places exist. Well, when the labor market heats up as much as it has, it pulls some of those folks in off the sidelines. Now, you mentioned the 25 to 54 group. Yes, there's been some discouragement there, but even those folks have picked up the pace, and their employment rates are close to where they were, are now kind of closing in on where they were before the last recession. So we are seeing this pull people back in. Getting back to my earlier analogy, we're finding out that there's a little more room in that water glass than we thought. And, you know, that's a function of the tightening job market. That said, there are people with very significant problems, sometimes related to opioids, that can't be reached by a tight labor market. They need a lot more help than that.
Yeah. Another interesting piece of the kind of demographics of what's driving the labor force participation rate higher is women, particularly 25 to 34 years old. Their labor force participation rate is now at 76.8%, which is the highest since 2000. It certainly looks like women are really kind of driving the increase in labor force participation. What are you seeing there?
Women have done better than men by some of these indicators. And again, we probably have more to learn about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's some health, maybe some addiction results there, which isn't to say that women are immune from those problems. I think the longer term thing to consider vis-a-vis these gender differences is the long term shift in the economy from manufacturing to services. And so this problem of employment rates among what we call prime age men, 25 to 54, this is not a new thing. In fact, the downward trend has been a 50-year phenomenon along a more cyclical kind of pattern around recessions and recovery. So yes, these prime age guys lose jobs in recessions and they gain them back in recoveries, but they lose more and they gain back less as the years have proceeded. Now, they're actually doing a little bit better this time around. But that industrial shift out of manufacturing and into service was going on for a long time, very much exacerbated by trade deficits in the 2000s, by the way, which is kind of a germane political topic these days. That's a real thing, too.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, what the Democrats' argument will be in 2020, you know, if the unemployment rate is, you know, down at historic lows and the participation rate is rising. I mean, certainly the Trump administration will argue that their economic policies are working and, you know, the economy is getting better. What do Democrats need to say to counter that and to say we've got a better plan for addressing some of the structural problems in the economy?
Well, first, let me challenge the premise of your question. Now, again, I think forecasting a few years out is kind of a science fiction-y thing to do, so I'll take this with a grain of salt. But I would be pretty surprised, based on some policies that are baked in the cake, if we're looking at as good a labor market in 2020 as we are now. So, for example, I talked earlier about the Keynesian sort of stimulus is, I think of it as upside down Keynesianism, because we're stimulating an economy that's very strong instead of the traditional Keynesian stimulus when you're in a downturn. But we've been engaged in all of this stimulus, but it's going to fade. It's scheduled to fade at the end of this year. And unless Congress does a ton more deficit spending, which I don't think they will, especially given their new political composition up there, we're going to have slower growth and slower job growth. Unemployment's going to be ticking up. So that kind of changes the conversation in a very big way. I mean, Trump can basically say, you know, in so many words, you want to say I'm crazy, you want to say I'm chaotic and nuts and incompetent, you know, how come the unemployment rate's at a 50-year low? So he, once you take that foundational argument away from him, I think the paper-thin substance of his administration faces a new and serious threat. So that's my reframing of your question. Now, to take your question, like, let's say the conditions were like they are today, you know, then I would suggest look at the midterms. So the midterms, the economy was really strong, and it didn't seem to play much of a role. I'm not 100% sure why. I suspect you might have better insights into that to me. But the old, it's the economy, stupid, didn't seem to apply in the midterms. And Trump does a very strange thing in this regard, which is that unlike other politicians, of course, you know, he's very sui generis in lots of ways, but he doesn't ever seem to really run on the economy. He seems to get sidetracked into all these other things that has, you know, really appealed to his base. So it's not a slam dunk assumption that even if there's a strong economy, he will be immune from attacks on all the chaos he creates. And remember, the Democratic base is, you know, really antithetical to kind of the Trump base that he appeals to, like around wall arguments, his xenophobia, his racism. These issues, I think, dominate, at least they did in the midterms.
And do you think that, you know, when there's ultimately a Democratic nominee, that they can talk the way some Democrats are talking now? And obviously, I'm thinking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about a 70% marginal tax rate on the top slice of income to help, you know, pay for stuff like a new Green Deal or single payer health insurance or, you know, college education for all. Do you think those kind of policies are going to resonate broadly with the electorate, that there's a window here to really kind of move the economic conversation in a very different direction?
I think so. I'm pretty sure that's the case. Now, I do think that the minute the Democrats go there, Medicare for all, free college, you know, forgiving your college debt, guaranteed jobs, the opposition will very quickly say, aha, you want to raise taxes on the average person by X thousand dollars. So it becomes that argument. A Green New Deal should have been on my list. You know, it becomes that argument very quickly. And that's been a potent argument for Republicans. So I don't think it's a slam dunk for Democrats to get in front of this progressive agenda and just kind of, you know, wave hands about paying for it. I think that's going to be a real part of the discussion. But I think the Democrats have the strong cards here. I think their progressive agenda is really smart and really important. I think the issue, though, is you have to get away from 10, 12, almost sort of Hillary-style point explanations of everything you plan to do and speak much more aspirationally. The aspirations here are for affordable health coverage, affordable college, to do something about climate, to help reach people who haven't been reached even by a full employment economy. Those are the aspirations Americans need to hear. And by the way, you know, Trump actually talks about them. And even in the midterms, it was the Republicans who, I think, very falsely argued, you know, we're the ones who are going to protect your health care. There's one famous Trump gaffe from the end of the midterms where he said, you know, vote for Republicans because Democrats might obliterate Obamacare. That's practically a quote. So those aspirations are out there. The difference is that a person like Representative Ocasio-Cortez, many of the other new members, many of whom to whom I've already spoken to, these are serious people with actual policy ideas. In fact, Ocasio-Cortez's 70% marginal tax rate, which is just on the top tiny slice of taxpayers above 10 million, already generated in 3 or 4 days a bunch of really interesting analysis, most of which was quite positive, at least from the economics community. Obviously, you know, the right wing was freaking out, but any arguments that, you know, she's crazy and doesn't know what she's talking about were quickly disposed of by no less than Nobel laureates like Paul Krugman. So it's the aspirations, it's the kind of ideas you're beginning to hear from folks like this that are exciting, inspiring. I'm excited about where we are right now. I don't think you can necessarily, you know, I'm not saying that a majority of the American electorate, particularly in electoral college important places, is going to, you know, vote for an agenda that devotes, you know, 25-30% of GDP to government, right, when we've typically been around the 20% level. But it's the right conversation to have.
And I want to talk quickly about, you know, debts and deficits. And obviously the Trump administration record on that is not at all good, given the increase in the size of annual deficits and the size of the national debt following the tax cuts. And they made the argument that eventually they'll pay for themselves. And I'm sure you don't accept that. And there's no evidence for it.
I do not.
so far. Has he sort of made that case easier for Democrats to say we can propose a lot of this stuff and not necessarily pay for it, and deficits and debt don't matter?
It's a great question, but let me just challenge one thing you said, which is you said, this thing hasn't paid for itself so far. Of course, that's true. But let's not act like this is our first supply side tax cut rodeo. They never pay for themselves. Tax cuts never, ever pay for themselves. They never did. They never will. That doesn't mean they don't recoup some of their costs, but they tend to be a fractional, marginal. In this case, they're particularly so because they were so poorly targeted. So we have a budget deficit as a share of GDP of around 4%. Historically, when the unemployment rate has been as low as it is right now, the budget deficit has been about zero. So this is a very unusual and I think reckless fiscal policy. Interestingly, I happen to spend the weekend at the retreat of the new members. I was talking to them about these issues. And I think there's a sense that the new members, particularly the Democrats, don't care about deficits. They are asking, themselves, why do we always have to be the fiscal grownups? Let's just put everything on the deficit. I think that's wrong. And I think Representative Ocasio-Cortez's proposal on the tax hike at the very top of the scale is evidence that they're actually thinking about more responsible fiscal policy, about pay-fors. Here's the difference. They're not obsessed with deficits. And if Republicans simply refuse to raise more revenues, which very well may be the case, they're not going to let that refusal serve as fiscal handcuffs. So they'd be willing to put some of their initiatives on the deficit for sure. But I think first they're going to try hard to identify pay-fors and to introduce a more responsible fiscal agenda. Because at the end of the day, I've talked to these people. They believe that a functional, amply funded government is really important. I don't know that they're quite sure how to get there yet, and I don't see them getting there in the next couple of years, given the divided Congress we're going to have. But this is my sense is that these are not people walking around saying we want to be as fiscally reckless as the other side.
So let's just sort of close by talking about, you know, fast forwarding to the 2020 campaign, and you've got, you know, Trump versus, you know, Biden or Booker or Harris or whomever winds up, or Elizabeth Warren as the Democratic nominee. And let's just sort of accept that you have similar, you know, job picture to what you have now. Maybe the, you know, unemployment rate has stopped dropping and the jobs numbers are in the 100,000s, not 200,000s. But what do they say to voters about, you know, what we're going to do to get some of these folks who have been out of the labor force back into the labor force, particularly in, you know, industries that have gone away or, you know, as you said, we've a much more services based economy. What is the overall message to those people?
I think it has a lot to do with the quality of their jobs and the quality of their lives. You know, the numbers we're citing, all these macroeconomic numbers, hundreds of thousands of jobs per month, even the unemployment rate, they don't mean anything to people out there pulling the voting levers. They care about their own living standards and the chances for their kids. And there you're getting into issues of wage stagnation. It is true that wages are growing now, but they're maybe growing a percent in real terms, and it's taken a while to get there. And the long-term stagnation of middle-class living standards is still very much a live issue. So this is an extremely familiar and rich target for Democrats where they can say, look what Trump did. They can point to the tax cuts, and they can point to corporate profitability, and they can say, yeah, there's been a lot of growth going on. But once again, it's kind of eluded a lot of people in the middle, despite the fact that Trump ran on helping you. I think that the Democratic candidate, whoever he or she may be, is going to be putting forth a lot of ideas, and we've talked about some of them in our discussion, whether it's in healthcare, employment, around the environment, that are going to gonna resonate with people. And I think the difference will be that after 4 years of Trumpian chaos and failed policies in this regard, probably a worsening of the inequality situation, the D's will have a substantive argument that will resonate with voters. That's certainly my hope.
Very good. Jared Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us on Politico Money. Hope to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
That's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks to my producer, Jenny Ament, and our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. We'll be back with you next week.